So this letter kind of forms his introduction, not only to himself, but to the message that he's going to speak. And we're suggesting that this particular chapter, these particular chapters, 6, 7, 8, comes to the core of what it means to be Christian and how we should function as Christians. In particular, Paul has addressed the fact that the Christian message deals with three basic orientations to the Christian life. It deals with three topics. First, it deals with sin. We've looked at that particularly, how Jesus' work deals with evil or rebellion in the world. That's chapters 1, 2, and the first part of chapter 3. Then we look, secondly, at how Jesus' word, his life, his message, and ultimately the Christian message, deals with the issue of death. That's primarily chapters 3, 4, and 5. Now when we come to 6, 7, and 8, he's dealing with the great big topic of how Jesus' life, death, and the Christian message deals with the topic of the law. Sin, or rebellion, death, physical, emotional, relational, separation kinds of issues, and finally the law. Or if you're simple like me and you want to kind of have a way to hang on to it, the first three chapters deal with the issue of my relationship upward. The second two or three deal with my relationship inward, and now Jesus' message deals with how that works outward. You with me so far? In other words, the nature of sin deals with the fact that, first of all, there's a break in my relationship between me and my Creator. My deliberate rebellion against God has resulted in His wrath, verse chapter 1, being displayed. And the way that the wrath of God is displayed is that God removes Himself from us and lets us try and live life on our own. Secondly, that has impact, my rebellion, on what's going on inside of me. In chapter 3, among other things, Paul says there's none that's righteous. There's nothing that's righteous inside, and I become separated from myself. I become a person who lacks integrity, integration. In fact, I live a disintegrity, a disintegrated life. Now, the result of all that is it has enormous impacts on the way I relate to other people. And one of the ways that historically both God and the state and even homes and churches have dealt with relational issues is they deal with it by constituting laws. Okay? The law is an attempt to limit personal behavior so that we can kind of get along. Now, in the Old Testament, that law was given by God through the Mosaic Covenant. Moses goes up on Sinai, comes down, not just with the Ten Commandments, but with 600 or so other laws. Because God's people basically don't want to live in relationship with Him. They just want to know what they can do. Some of us live that way too, don't we? We live that way in our family, in our relation, our marriages. Just tell me what you want to do, but don't mess with my head. Correct? Some of that happens in churches. Oh, we're great at laws in churches, aren't we? I joked with my good brother Dan Cordaway today. I liked his tie. He had no tie. He said, wait till next week. He's chairman next week. He'll wear a tie. But you know how easy it is to joke and make a preference a law. I grow up in churches like that all the time. Now, Paul's not suggesting that the law is bad, but that the life that's given to us by Jesus and identification with who He is changes the whole dynamic of how we'll deal with life. Look at it with me. Chapter 7, verses 1 to 6. I'll read the odd number verses. You join in and read with gusto and vigor the even numbered verses. Okay? Here we go. Do you not know, brothers, for I am speaking to men who know the law, that the law has authority over a man only as long as he lives? Together? For example, by law, a married woman is bound to her husband as long as he is alive. But if her husband dies, she is released from the law of marriage. So then, if she marries another man while her husband is still alive, she is called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she is released from that law and is not an adulteress, even though she marries another man. So, my brothers, you also died to the law through the body of Christ, that you might belong to another, to him who was raised from the dead, in order that we might bear fruit to God. For when we were controlled by the sinful nature, the sinful passions aroused by the law were at work in our bodies, so that we bore fruit for death. But now, by dying to what once bound us, we have been released from the law, so that we serve in the new way of the Spirit, and not in the old way of the written code. The key verse that we'll spend much of our time this morning on is verse 4. I want to read it again. Chapter 7, verse 4. So, my brothers, you also died to the law through the body of Christ, that you might belong to another, to him who was raised from the dead, in order that we might bear fruit to God. The answer in brief is this. The dead don't fear the law. The dead don't fear the law. It's interesting that Paul doesn't specify what he's talking about regarding the law, but there are several particular laws that have been mentioned earlier in the book. The first and foremost is the one I've mentioned before. Within the Jewish part of the Christian community, they would understand the law as the Mosaic covenantal law. Everything we have, particularly in the first five books of the Old Testament. But there was another law at work. It was called the Pax Romana, the law of Rome, the peace of Rome. This particular book comes to a collection of Christians who are living in the capital of the largest empire that the world has seen to that extent. And the peace of Rome was enforced by the laws of the state, by the military power behind those laws. People would know that unless they were born Roman, that they were therefore coerced by virtue of that civil and military law to obey what Rome dictated. There's another law that Paul talks about, particularly in chapter 2. It's called the law of the conscience. Basically, what Paul says is if you have had no contact with the Old Testament law, you're not without excuse because God has placed the law into your conscience, dictating what's right and wrong. We make moral or legal pronouncements all the time. In fact, you have it, even if you've not told your kids that. You've heard the complaint. It's not, what's the word? Moral pronouncement. Of course, my great response is, you're right, life's not fair, I'm in charge. You gotta use that, friends. I mean, it's the way you do life, you know? And now you say, and some of you have younger kids, the way it works, when you're the parent, then you can do with your kids what you want, but I'm the parent. You know, folks have forgotten that. My wife reminds me regularly of it, you see. The law of the conscience. In fact, by that very definition, we break the law of our own conscience repeatedly. Some of you are pretty good at that. You kick yourself. Why did I do that? So Paul briefly says, among other things, that there's at work here an obligation not to live under the law, but in service to Christ's Spirit. And that happens for Christians when they understand three things. And I've broken our section into three particular sections. Verse 1, which talks about the influence of moral authority. We've been suggesting that already. The law has a life force. We are under the authority of some sort of law. Secondly, we need to understand that the law has limits. And Paul utilizes the illustration of marriage to suggest how those limits work. And thirdly, that the result of coming to know Jesus means that we live under a new kind of loyalty that does not diminish the law, but makes it sort of not have the same force because we're living in another way. Or to put it in, I'm going to anticipate ahead, the law can't force you to love your spouse better. So far as I know, there's no law in the book that says you will love your wife more than you did yesterday. Each day we want you to love your wife more. Not that some wives don't wish that that law was there, but you can't force someone to love. But a person who comes under the influence of the love of God becomes motivated to love in ways that the law can't coerce. Hence, the new loyalty means that we live in a different way. Look again, chapter 7, verse 1. Do you not know, brothers, for I am speaking to men who know the law, that the law has authority? it has authority. The law has authority because no matter which law you talk about, there are obligations that we live under. I'm fascinated by the continuing myth, the continuing lie that seems to suggest that we are not responsible for anybody or anything. One of the great travesties of our culture has been the ultimate bringing down to the grassroots of a philosophy that was generated during the 1930s and 40s known as existentialism. And what happens with those people, particularly Sartre, Camus, other people, Beckett, is that they believe that the law, the essence of the person, was derived inside the person. It didn't come from outside. I won't go into the particulars of the philosophy, but the way it works in cultural, popular culture at this point is that I'm just doing my own thing. I'm not responsible to anybody else. Paul says, no way. The law has authority. We all live under it. We live under it not only in a moral sense and a legal sense, but in a deeply spiritual sense. God is in charge of life, and his law must be obeyed. You seek to try and diminish it, you end up only killing yourself and hurting yourself. Paul suggests that the principle is laid down that the law has a lifelong obligation on its subjects, but, and here we get to the nature of it, that the law only has that obligation as long as the person's alive. Now, before we get to the fact of how Paul works this out, understand that everyone lives under the law's authority. If you have not identified yourself with Jesus, then you are under the obligation of the law. Secondly, people who know the law instinctively know this reach. That's why there's so much fighting against it. In fact, one of the things that happens is that when a law is imposed, our initial reaction is to see how we can get around it. On my way to church, on my way to this building, which I go regularly, if I don't want to do the interstate and fight all the traffic there, I tend to go up Noank-Ledyard Road. They have done a dastardly thing. They put a stop sign there. I can see the cars coming this way. It's a Y, you know, one of those things. It's a Y. It's not like a T where you can't see around the building. But for many years, 20 or so, there was no stop sign. There's a stop sign there. Do you know what I like to do? I have all sorts of reasons why I shouldn't. I mean, I can save gas. But a law has been established at a place where I don't think it should be. And so by rights, I should stop. I should not call it the California octagonal yield sign. You know, I mean, I should stop. I use a trite illustration. But you see, when the stop sign is put there, my every instinct is to find a way to ignore it. It's an affront to me. In my neighborhood, cars go zooming by my house. There are little kids across the street. So the neighbors got together and put a petition up. And we put a three-way stop right by our house. You should see what kind of muttering and cursing that did. And to enforce the stop sign, for several weeks, the police car stood right there. You know, folk were used to going 40. Now all of a sudden have to stop right by my house. The law has authority. But the law has a limit. Note how Paul could have used some other illustrations. He could have used an illustration from educational law. And that is that the teacher has authority while the people in their class are students. What's fascinating to me is how the roles shift when all of a sudden you graduate and you're no longer a student. In fact, if you become a taxpayer in the town, you pay for the taxes of the teacher. Actually, fascinating reversal. Or he could have used an example from athletic law. For example, Darryl Strawberry has come under some particular criticism recently, right? He violated the rules of baseball. Tested positive for cocaine. Does it allow him to play or not? Now, once he's ruled ineligible, it doesn't matter how good he is. He can't play anymore. But instead, Paul talks about the limits of law using the illustration of marriage. Look at chapter 7, verses 2 and 3. To illustrate the binding character of the law, Paul represents or presents the example of a woman who's married to a husband and remains bound by law to that relationship as long as the husband is living. During this time, she is not free to seek another attachment. This may be done only in the event that the husband dies. What's fascinating is the word that Paul uses. This picture is presented by the term hypandros. It's a rarely used word in the New Testament. It literally means under the husband. The picture is more readily available than a married woman, which Paul's seeking to bring out. What Paul's suggesting, particularly in Jewish life, is that the legal status for the wife was that she could not divorce her husband. Divorce was a privilege granted only to the man. If the husband died, then she was released from, quote, the law of the husband. That's what the literal Greek word means. This may sound as though the husband instituted the marriage law, but that's not the idea intended here. Instead, the translators have wisely avoided the word under the law of the husband and said she's discharged from the law of marriage or marital obligation. Now, I want to, not to particularly use a huge digression here, and I'm not particularly suggesting that this is the sum total of the Bible's teaching about marriage and divorce. We can save that for another time. Paul's using, though, the point, the illustration, that while people are married to a person, they should stay married to them, much like while people are alive, they are under the obligation of the law. When I do marriage ceremonies, I particularly ask people whether they are willing to commit to it. The words go like this: will you have this woman or this man to be your wedded wife, husband? After God's own ordinance, will you love, cherish, honor, and protect him or her in sickness and health, and forsaking all others, keep yourselves for him or her only? What's the last phrase? As long as you both shall live. You know, in some ways, don't get me wrong on this, weddings and funerals are a lot alike, because they both represent the death of something and the release of something. When a guy and a girl come together, they are proclaiming the death of their singleness. They are saying that essentially they are dead to all other relationships. They died. They are taken off the market. In fact, if you look at someone else, it's cause to what sort of person are you? Now, Paul's making this point, that the law has obligations on us as long as we live. Now, you understand where he's going with this. He's basically saying that you're not alive. You've died. And this becomes the enormous dynamic. One of the things I suggest just in passing is that one of the things that's true about the divorce culture that we live in is it does violence with the permanence by which we are attached to the law, even if we want to be free from it. And one of the horrors that I think of marriages that don't succeed is the fact that folk think they're becoming free of something, but in fact they don't get free of it. It makes life more complicated. We live with that day in and day out. Now let's get to the key verse, verse 4. Paul's suggesting that by virtue of the fact that Jesus has died, that we are released from the obligations to the law. And Paul suggests in verse 4 in particular that there are four ways in which this freedom becomes real in our lives. I've suggested them on the outline. There are four ways to freedom. The first is by identification. The second is by transfer. The third is by legacy. And the fourth is by participation. I'm going to use an extended illustration to help you understand what Paul's saying in very technical terms here, but in fact very, very easy to understand ones. The verse is divided into four parts. Chapter 7, verse 4, note the first section. So, my brothers, you died to the law through the body of Christ. In other words, I have identified that when Jesus died, I died. That in some respects I see that his death and suffering were not just for him alone, but I've come to believe that when he died, I died with him. I identify myself with his death. We do this all the time. Recently, I continued my identification with the not-so-mighty Fitch Falcon swimming and diving team. You know, we're on hard times. I'm very used to this. I'm also a Boston Red Sox fan. You know how that works, okay? But my identification goes to this. Because I love this team so much, I decided to show my identification. You see? I bought a new shirt. Not a great shirt. I wish the team was as good as the shirt. You see? But I wear the shirt. I identify with the team. I go to the swim meets from now on. I'm going to wear it. It's really big, but I'm going to grow. You know how that works. I've got a big shirt like that. And it's a beautiful shirt. And I identify with the team. In the same way, in an external way, we are called to identify with Jesus. The identification is an external way by which we understand our connection. As I wear the shirt, I'm proclaiming outside to everyone else that my identification is with this team. By the way, friends, baptism functions that way. It's an external, out-in-the-open sort of thing where, in about a month or so, a group of folk will get up before you on Sunday morning with inviting their friends and relatives and whatever, and they will get wet in the tank right behind me. The reason for that is they're making a public and external identification, saying, we no longer belong to ourselves, we have identified with Jesus in his death, burial, and resurrection. But Paul goes deeper than identification. Of course, the question becomes, can people see by the externals of your life who you're identified with? Can they? By how you act, do folk know that you don't belong to yourself? Paul goes deeper than that. The second part of the verse says that we do it by transfer or by belonging. Note it says that you might belong to another. Paul says that as a result of Jesus' death, a sort of cosmic or spiritual transference of ownership or belonging has taken place. I'm not a mere observer or spectator. It's not just a result of the fact that I do something on the outside. It's not enough just to wear the clothing. That's what a fan does. But something deeper than identification occurs. It's called ownership. And I have inside transferred who I belong to from me to Jesus. Now, I do that too regarding the not so mighty Fitch Falcons swimming and diving champ. Why do I have loyalty to that team? Well, it's because a couple years ago, my own flesh and blood swam on that team. I went and became a willing slave to wake up at all sorts of crazy hours on Saturday morning to bring them to practice. Part of me was that team. In the same way, a deeper sort of relationship occurs. I belong to another person. We don't have slavery in our culture, but that's the essence of it. We've been transferred from one sort of ownership to another sort of ownership. And I recognize I don't belong to me, I belong to Jesus. Due to the work of Jesus, to whom I was and I am related, both by flesh, Jesus participated in flesh and blood. By sacrifice, he died for me. I belong to God's family. Notice how Paul underscores that in the text, calling these Christians he's never met in Rome, my brothers, my sisters. I think it would be kind of neat as we leave this morning if you went up to someone and said, Brother Tom, Sister Mary, how's my brother doing? How's my sister doing? But Paul goes deeper than that. He says in the next section, we belong to another, to him who was raised from the dead. Christianity is nothing if it's not a historical religion. The great victory of Jesus' resurrection provides Christians with a legacy, a history, which links them to their victor and to his victory. The kids sang about it. I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will never die. We do this all the time with the Fitch Falcon swimming and diving championship. Some of us do it by videotapes. She's not here, but if you want to know previous exploits of our victory, talk to Nikki Hammerstrom. She's got stacks of them. Virtually every meet, she's taken a videotape of it. And sometimes at team parties, we replay the old victories. It's great. I get excited. Yeah, I get excited because I even know we're going to win, but it's so exciting to see me win again. Not me. I mean, you know how that works. You see? It happened just this week. We celebrated the 10th anniversary of the United States Olympic team hockey team beating the Soviet Union. I remember driving home from New York that day. Reports would come. I kept driving. We do it every Sunday night here in this room. We celebrate a victory. The death, the burial, and resurrection of Jesus is a way in which we remember our legacy. We remember the great victory. Some of us do it this way. We keep track of team records. How fast? I carry a combination lock when I go swimming at Conn College. I can set the combination of that lock to whatever I want. I put it to the time that my son had breaking a record. I was so excited the numbers will always be burned into my thinking. Can never forget that number. Won't tell you what it is. It's a secret. No, it's not. So from here on out, 2265 is a number burned into my consciousness. See? What is your history? But Paul goes even deeper. He says that we are called not merely to identify with Jesus' work, not merely to transfer our loyalty, change our sense of belonging, not merely to remember our history, understand our legacy, but he says that we should, in order that we might bear fruit to God. In other words, Paul calls us not from an external identification, a remembering of our life, a recognition of who we belong to, but he calls us to participate in the very life of Jesus. I have a dream. I was thinking about this, had this dream. It's the championships of the world, and Fitch Swimming and Diving is on one side, and the whole rest of the world somewhere else. And as the cosmic thing has happened, it's a dream. Remember, give me some, kind of license here, okay? As this happens, the dream occurs, and it turns out that Fitch versus the world has resulted in a tie. So the announcer makes an announcement into the stands. I see myself at Conn College. It's kind of where all the ECC championships were that we did our great thing. You know how that is. The mighty victories are there and all that stuff. And the announcer says, we need to break the tie. Need to break the tie. And this, whoever wins the next race, the team, Fitch versus the world, will be declared champions for eternity. New rule. Now, to make this happen, we need anybody who's over 50 years of age to swim. Murmuring occurs in the stands. I start to sweat under the armpits here, realizing that I'm over 50 years of age. Who will be the champion? I say to myself, I'll swim for the honor of Fitch against the world. It's a dream, friends. Give me that, okay? But I'm prepared. I not only have my shirt on, I brought my goggles. And I got my bathing suit. Put that bathing suit in there. I take off my shirt. I lay aside, go into the locker room, lay aside the things that so closely cling. I get up on the blocks. I've been training for it, friends. I refortify myself by remembering Matt Hammerstrom, Sabrina Noel, Todd McCoy, Matt Raw, the heroes of the past of Fitch Swimming and Diving. They're all out there and they're cheering, go Bob! I get up there and I shake my arms out. I've seen them do it. I figure that's okay. I shake my legs out. I get up on the block and there's been another competitor drawn from somewhere, but he doesn't stand a chance. Because I'm a member. I participate now. I'm going to dive in. And I'm going to bear fruit. Will you? See, friends, one of the huge problems of Christianity is it's so easy to wear the shirt. In some ways, it's a little bit easier to transfer ownership. Yeah, I'll kind of let Jesus have his thing. It's great to celebrate the victories of the past. But this kick of participating, to living the life of Jesus, allowing his grace to be the motivating thing of our life, becomes one whale of a hard thing. And God doesn't call us to one race. He calls us to a daily fight. If you don't allow the life of the Spirit and the grace of God to motivate you, then you devolve into a life of rules. And the law still has authority over you. So I call you, friends. I don't know what your dream is. I dream about swimming. I love to swim. But more than that, I dream about living because I want to live. Some of you are facing contests that are much harder than swimming a race. Some of you are facing difficulties because you are in a work situation, a family situation, a life situation that seems overwhelming to you. And when someone like me calls you to get up out of the stands and to no longer be a spectator, even a fan, but to be a participant in it, there are all sorts of red flags that go up. Not me, get somebody else to do it. But you see, the announcer from the stands kind of narrows it down. And in my dream, I don't have a choice. It's not only someone that's 50, but someone who has no hair. You know how that works. It's somebody who lives in Mystic, who lives on Farmstead Avenue, who lives on 96 Farmstead Avenue, who's the only 50-year-old male on Farmstead Avenue, and that's me. And God calls each of us so that there's no other choice but for us to dive in. I included on the back of the notes the words to a song that Stephen Curtis Chapman sings. We won't take the time to play it, but I want to read them to you. It's a great song. The long-awaited rains have fallen upon the thirsty ground and carved their way to where the wild and rushing river can be found. And like the rains, I have been carried to where the river flows. My heart is racing and my knees are weak as I walk to the edge. I know there is no turning back. Once my feet have left the ledge, and in the rush I hear a voice that's telling me it's time to take the leap of faith. So here I go. I'm diving in. I'm going deep in over my head. I want to be caught in the rush, lost in the flow. In over my head I want to go. The river's deep, the river's wide. The river's water is alive. So sink or swim, I'm diving in. There is a supernatural power in this mighty river's flow. It can bring the dead to life, and it can fill an empty soul and give our heart the only thing worth living and worth dying for. But we'll never know the awesome power of the grace of God until we let ourselves get swept away into this holy flood. So if you'll take my hand, we'll close our eyes and count to three and take the leap of faith. Come on. Let's go. I'm diving in. You'd be willing to dive in today. You're going to dive. You don't know the nature of the life of the Spirit and God's grace until you let everything else go. Would you, Father, take the words that your Spirit prompted Paul to write to a community of believers almost 2,000 years ago and burn them into our soul? Allow us to be folk who don't live under bondage to the law, but as dead men now walking, alive to a new sort of reality, allow us to identify, to transfer, to remember, and to participate in the great life of your Spirit. Father, I don't know how this will all work out in my life or the lives of my brothers and sisters here in the coming week, but thank you that you walk with us. You surround us with that river of grace. May it be true in Jesus' name.